The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And then, much like day two, rapid fire, jurors were seated, were impaneled rather, and we ended with a full panel plus an alternate, which was, like I said, I think if you had told me that at 11 a.m., I wouldn't have believed you. But here we are. It was two steps back and many steps forward.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 20th, 2024. It's another episode of Trump's Trials and Tribulations, recorded on April 18th in front of a live audience on YouTube and Riverside. I sat down with Roger Parloff to talk about oral arguments at the Supreme Court in Fisher versus the United States over an obstruction charge used to charge hundreds of January 6th defendants, including President Trump. We also checked in on Judge Cannon and last week's hearings on motions from Trump co-defendants De Oliveira and Nata. We also checked in with Tyler McBrien, who came in midstream fresh from the ongoing jury selection in the hush money case in New York. Why is jury selection going faster than expected? And can we really expect opening statements in the case to occur on Monday? And yes, I went on a bit of a rant about the criticism that our people in the New York court have been taking on Twitter and elsewhere over their coverage of jury selection. Of course, we also took audience questions from Lawfare material supporters on Riverside. You should become one of those material supporters. You know how to do it. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 20th, Trump Trials and Tribulations, 13 jurors down, 5 to go. Roger, we're going to start with Fisher. Give us a reminder for those who have not been following, and I said on the Bulwark, on Rational Security, sorry, the other day that 98% of everything that's been worth reading on the subject of Fisher has been written by Roger Parloff on Lawfare, and 99% of coverage of the lower court proceedings that was worth reading was written by Roger. So what is this case? What does it have to do with Donald Trump? And why are we delaying talking about jury selection other than that Tyler isn't here to talk about Fisher versus United States?
Yeah, this is a case about a very important statute in the January 6th cases. It's called Corrupt Obstruction of an Official Proceeding. It's at 18 U.S.C. 1512 C2. And it's been a problem that's been brewing for about 3 years. And we care about it because at least 353 January 6th defendants were charged with it, which is about a quarter. We've had 1,387 defendants charged as of April 5th. But we also care because two of the counts in D.C. against Trump are basically this count. One is the substantive count of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding, and the other is conspiracy to corruptly obstruct 18 U.S.C. 1512K in that instance. I can say initially, spoiler alert, I'll give the outcome and then I'll tell you what was at stake. I think my impression was that the DOJ had a bad day. We'll lose at least 5-4, possibly 7-2, as far as whether it's been using the statute correctly in the January 6th cases. But there's much more. We'll have to see how they write it to know whether it affects the charges against Trump, which are significantly different. And there's a slight outside chance that even the January 6th defendants like Fisher might not get away scot-free from this charge.
So before we dive into the details of what the legal problem is here, let's talk a little bit about the data regarding who this affects. Imagine for a moment a maximalist Supreme Court opinion that wipes out completely as many cases as possible, which may or may not be the most likely outcome, but is a possible outcome. So first of all, let's talk about to Trump, what does it do? It knocks out two charges.
Well, that would really have to be maximal. That would have to be the worst.
Right, but yeah, let's start with the most dramatic scenario.
Okay.
Maximalist, five justices say 1512C2 requires that you have burned a document or, you know, some kind of mutilation that's not covered by the word mutilation, right? But it actually means physical impairment of the ability of a court to see evidence. And again, for those for whom I sound like I'm speaking gibberish right now, we're going to come to the question in the case in a moment. But let's take a maximalist opinion so that it wipes out two charges against Donald Trump. What does that really do as the Solicitor General in the Trump case now, as the Solicitor General says, this is really going to be, if assuming somebody is convicted, it's really a sentencing guidelines question, not a statutory max question, what the person gets in the way of a sentence. So what does it matter if 1512C2 applies to Donald Trump's case or not?
Well, you're right. There are two other counts. We have yet to see if, you know, problems might arise with those. But yeah, it is the most serious count at the moment. It has a maximum of 20 years, but that is usually reflected in the sentencing guidelines. You know, it's been until recently, it's been the most important baseline for the sentencing guidelines. That's changing recently a little bit, even before Fisher, because of another ruling it gets that relates to the sentencing guidelines. But you know, in terms of where you start, I think that's an important place. But it's true, there's two more charges, one of which is 241 has not been used very often, and the other is just a 5-year max. And frankly, I mean, if if he were to be found responsible for basically January 6th, you know, there's a lot of people that went to jail for a lot longer than 5 years because of him, if that's how this works out. And I don't think a 5-year felony is necessarily the right one. So I mean, it has that potential.
Right. So it lessens but does not, a maximalist version lessens but does not eliminate the Trump case. With respect to the 340 convictions, how many of those people would their convictions be entirely wiped out? And how many of them are people that this is one charge and that would require resentencing, but it wouldn't mean they walk away?
Yeah, most people were charged with more than one felony. And I don't have an exact figure on how many were where this was the only felony, but the Solicitor General did say that there were 50 cases in which people with only one felony, where this was the only felony, have been sentenced. She talked about that a little bit. And so that, to me, extrapolating, would suggest maybe around 75 people total that were charged with this as the sole felony. And we do know some of the people that this would affect. The famous, the fellow that brought in the Confederate flag, who, in fact, Kevin Seafried, who, in fact, will shortly be released early because of the likelihood of reversal. His release date, I don't think, would have been until September of 2025, but he's going to be released and while we await the ruling, because the misdemeanor sentence will end very shortly. There's a lot of people, there are people who have finished their terms, like Jacob Chansley. I believe there's a lot of people who pled guilty and where this was the only charge. So by my reckoning, like Joshua Pruitt, who was a Proud Boy, almost encountered Charles Schumer near the elevators.
Encountered is a very generous word for what he almost did to Charles Schumer.
I think his release date is around December 2025. I think this is the only count against him. Nick DiCarlo, Nick Oakes, more Proud Boys. They called themselves Murder the Media. They carved their initials into a memorial door. They are due to get out December 2025. I think a maximalist reading would spring them. And there's a lot of people where this was the only. There were cooperators where this was the only charge also. Matt Green, Jason Dolan of the Oath Keepers, Mark Rods, Caleb Berry, Graydon Young of the Oath Keepers, Charles Donahoe, who's already been released. So I'm not exactly sure. Some of those people were very productive cooperators, so maybe the government doesn't really care. I don't think they're in custody currently. Another interesting one is Thomas Caldwell, who was originally charged with seditious conspiracy, along with in the same trial as Stuart Rhodes. And he was acquitted on all of the conspiracies, but convicted on this as a substantive crime, and then also a substantive obstruction destroying things in his phone when he realized he was about to get arrested. He has not been sentenced yet. This could help him a lot.
So here's I'm embarrassed to say I've never thought through this question and I don't know the answer to it. But if you enter into a plea agreement and then the statute, you agree to plea, the statute's not being struck down, but it no longer seems to apply to the conduct that you pled to. Do you, A, walk away? Does it, B, void the plea agreement such that you are now subject to whatever charges other than 1512C the government wants to throw at you? Or do we, I mean, we must know, there must be an known answer to that question, right? Like, what happens to these, I mean, the ones who are convicted at trial, obviously, they walk. But the ones who pled only to 1512C, is this a windfall for them? Or does it void their agreement such that they're now vulnerable to other charges?
Yeah, I don't know either, but I can't believe that they, and it's true, you normally, you waive appeal, among other things, when you plead guilty, but I can't believe that they would be punished for cooperating, that the result would be worse for them than for the people that fought and went to trial. and, you know, they pled to a thing that doesn't exist. So my assumption is that they will benefit from this. Maybe I'm wrong. And also what happens usually is when you plead, the other charges are dismissed, I thought, with prejudice. So I don't know exactly about whether you can, have a do-over or...
Right. Does the voiding of the plea agreement cause that to...
Yeah.
So we will obviously have to look into that in about 300 cases, assuming, or at least 75, assuming that the court goes in the direction that we sort of expect it to go. So now with that as... So it's fair to say the consequences of a maximalist reading here are big, significant, highly significant for a bunch of cases, but not catastrophic. Is that a fair...
I think that's right.
It sort of depends on your definition of catastrophe, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, Alan Foyer did a story, said there are 10 people that have already been prematurely released from prison to await the outcome, since if they win, they'll have done all of their time already. I think there will be a lot of resentencings also among, you know, those, because this will have been a key. And some of the judges have said contradictory things about what might happen in such an event. I think Royce Lamberth said something about that he might use consecutive sentences of misdemeanors to beef up the max. Beryl Howell has said things the opposite, that, you know, that's sort of
cheating,
not the default. Yeah, it's rarely done, and she sort of doubted you. But I'm sure it would depend on the facts of the individual case.
Right, and the fact, just to emphasize that point, the facts of the individual case that can be encompassed within this statute are pretty vast. Some of them are people who could have been charged with more misdemeanory trespassing-like stuff. Some of them are people who this is one of the less violent things that they're charged with. And so I think it sort of depends whether you're looking at somebody for whom you might otherwise have a little bit of sympathy, or whether you're looking at somebody who seems like one of the really bad January 6th actors. All right. So with all of that as a giant prelude, let's talk about the issue here. The issue boils down to how to interpret the word otherwise. And I'm just going to say that and press go on Roger. And, what's the Fisher issue?
Yeah, so the crime is 1512C2. And so it turns out we need to look at 1512C1 also in order to interpret C2. So the statute is whoever corruptly, and then C1 is alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a document, ... with intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding. Okay, that's one. So basically spoliation of evidence, lawyers say, fiddling with evidence. Or two, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. So the Justice Department says, okay, whoever corruptly ... obstructs, influences, or impedes a proceeding, that covers all these people. And most judges, in fact, at least 14 district judges, agreed with that. One judge, Carl Nichols, didn't. And he said, well, wait a minute, you've skipped over the word otherwise in 1512C2. That, you know, it's not surplusage. We need to give it meaning. And he thought that otherwise should mean it must be obstructing, influencing, impeding in other ways that are sort of like number one. In fact, that are awfully like number one, altering, destroying, mutilating. So he limited it to other ways of destroying a record, basically. That was appealed by three defendants who had their charges dismissed by Judge Nichols, the one who accepted this argument. And on appeal, Judge Nichols' view wasn't really... It's a moving target here. Judge Nichols had a very narrow interpretation, and it would have contradicted lots of cases in other circuits, by other circuit courts. And so Judge Katsas, who's a conservative judge on the court, D.C. Circuit, gave it a more plausible conservative reading. It's a little broader than Nichols. And he said, well, okay, you don't have to destroy a record per se, but it has to at least have something to do with impairing the integrity or the availability of evidence. Now, the word evidence doesn't appear here, but anyway, he gleans that from 1512c1. And so that is the argument that Jeff Green of the Northwestern University, I forget the exact name, but a law clinic there, he's a very good lawyer, he pursued that argument. And it has a corollary, which is that, you know, if it's really about impairing availability and integrity of evidence, doesn't it follow that the official proceeding has to be an evidentiary proceeding? And the joint session of Congress on January 6th is not, you know, a congressional investigation or a probe that takes evidence. It is lawyers would say a ministerial proceeding. The vice president gets envelopes, he opens them up, and he counts votes. So another part of this becomes, it's not even the correct sort of proceeding. Now, that's the part that if the Supreme Court goes that far and adopts that part of the ruling, that seems to doom the Trump charges. The Trump charges are different from the January 6th charges, because most January 6th defendants have nothing whatsoever to do with pieces of paper, or very little. I mean, unless you say the fact that there were, you know, the Congress was counting pieces of paper that day. But the charges against, for the most part, they were storming the Capitol and preventing the proceeding from taking place. With Trump, there is a big part of the indictment that is the false elector scheme, you know, creating fraudulent certificates, these fraudulent elector certificates.
It seemed to me the most interesting justice in this argument was Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who said, wait a minute, what if we say there's some link to tampering with stuff? But if you're storming the Capitol in order to prevent the joint session of Congress from meeting to receive and process and count the electoral votes, which are, of course, themselves pieces of paper that you could mutilate or shred or do all those C1-y kind of things to, why doesn't C2 apply to something like that? Now, granted, Judge Katsas would say, well, because this isn't really an evidentiary proceeding at all, but it seems to me she was proposing a pretty interesting middle ground, which is that it has to have something to do with destroying paper or evidence or documents or something, but let's not be too finicky about what it means. Like, that would, Trump's case would certainly survive that ruling. Do you think she was just kind of playing, or do you think she's genuinely attracted to that sort of reading?
Well, it wasn't just her. I think it was her and Ketanji Jackson as well, Brown Jackson as well. And that is an argument that the DOJ has dropped into their briefs going back to the cases before Nichols as a fallback. You know, even if you do blah, 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 we think such and such. So it's not a preposterous. It's certainly not the strong. It's not what the advocate Jeff Green on behalf of Fisher was saying. It's not likely. But yeah, that it's, and that would not only save the counts against Trump, that would save the counts against Fisher. That would save all of these counts. They would all go back. I mean, you might have to retry some cases because the theory is a little different, but Fisher has never been tried. His case was dismissed. So it would be revised and he would have to go to trial on this.
So it's fair to say that there are four justices who are at least somewhat interested in government fallback arguments. There are also a number of justices who...
Well, I only heard two.
Well, so there are two, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, who seem attracted to the full...
The full
version of the government's argument.
Yeah, yeah.
There's two justices who seem interested in this intermediary position. And then there are five justices who, to one degree or another, seem quite hostile to the government's position. And I want to focus for a minute on two of them, the Chief Justice and Brett Kavanaugh, who the other three seem to me to be ungettable from the government's point of view. But these two seem to have a very specific concern. And I mean, I've followed Roberts's criminal law jurisprudence for long enough to know that it is by no means limited to this case. He's very suspicious of broad readings of ambiguous federal criminal statutes, particularly but not exclusively in white collar cases, the McDonnell case and the, and so he's actually, I think, being consistent here. He's looking for a way to narrow a statute that, narrow by interpretation, a statute that could have very, very broad implications if you interpreted it the way the government urges. And both he and Kavanaugh seemed to be pretty hostile to the idea that there would be essentially no linkage between C1 and C2, which is the government's core position. So my question is, do you see any scenario in which Justices Barrett and Jackson and these two others, is there any daylight? Is there any way you could thread a needle between their positions that would lead to some kind of a compromise outcome? Or at the end of the day, is it pretty binary?
I didn't get that. I felt that the five were unreachable. I thought that Justice Roberts, he had decided a case Friday. He had written a ruling Friday. I think it's called Bissonnette. It's a short case. I think it was unanimous. And it uses this statutory canon, justem generis or ejusdem generis. The other statutory canon here being is something like nascitur socius.
I just want to say, memo to all the justices, none of you has good Latin, and this whole trotting out canons in Latin is really precious, and you guys are better than that. Stop doing it.
But he was very wedded to it and proud of it, and he said, "That's where he's going, isn't this? This is for him. This is what that means. Basically, justem generis means basically if you have a generic term, you look at the words that came before it, and sort of it should be something along those lines. And then the other one is basically a word is known by its company. And the trouble with that, and I really was impressed with Barrett here, is that, you know, that sort of thing works. If this statute had been written differently and had said alters, destroys, mutilates, conceals or otherwise impairs the integrity of evidence, fine. But it doesn't. And it would have been easy to write that.
And just to be clear, what it says is, or otherwise obstructs an official proceeding.
Exactly. They have different verbs. They have different intent. And that's what Barrett was saying. You know, you can't really, she's a textualist too. And she was saying, you know, you can't really do it with this statute. It doesn't, how would you do it? And Jeff Green admitted, yeah, it's awkward, but it's always awkward. Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's always awkward. That might be a sign that this isn't the way to interpret what Congress wrote. But anyway, I just was not that, did not see any
ray of common ground.
No.
All right. So I want to talk about one of the conservative justices who I thought asked some very difficult questions of the Solicitor General. And by the way, I just want to say this was an exceptionally well-argued case on both sides. And the Solicitor General, Roger, has spoken about Mr. Green, who argued for Fisher. But the Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preligar, was terrific as well. And actually, this set of exchanges with Justice Alito, for those of you who like appellate argument, go listen to it. It's he really dealt her a hard hand, and she played it very well. That said, I think he landed some serious punches. And the example he kept coming back to is, remember, this is a 20-year felony, is protesters in the Supreme Court who impede the business of the, impede is one of the verbs in, so you don't merely have to obstruct, you can merely impede, which means delay, the oral argument of this case by yelling and refusing to stop yelling, and who do it corruptly, knowing that it's wrong. Are we really saying that you can put them in prison for 20 years? And S.G. Preligar was a gamer about it, and she basically said, well, I don't know if we would have the state of mind, right? And she sort of did a little bit of work with the mens rea, but she also did a lot of work with, well, it wouldn't be 20 years, which is another way of, you know, this would be decided by the sentencing guidelines, which is another way of saying, yeah, those people would be guilty of the same crime. Those nonviolent protesters who yell things in the Supreme Court, who never get charged with serious felonies, by the way, would be guilty of the same crime as the January 6th protesters. And I have to say, I really think Alito had a point in that instance, and it ever so slightly changed my feelings about the merits of this thing. So I'm curious what you made of that exchange between Justice Alito and the Solicitor General.
Yeah, I mean, she did in the end rely a lot on the sentencing guidelines, on prosecutorial discretion, and the difficulty in proving corruptly, and also what she said, the nexus to the official proceeding. But no, you're right, and it's broad, and you know, it's a question of how comfortable are you with that, and given that the language to me seems very clear. Now, I guess for them, at some point, the language may be clear, but it becomes a due process problem, that it's too broad, it's too vague, and so we interpret it to prevent the due process problem. But I didn't feel that way. But it is true in the January 6th cases, you will sometimes, you know, how do you draw the line between some of these people that get charged with the misdemeanor and some get charged with 1512C2 if they aren't among the most violent.
Right.
And it's often, I mean, one thing is obviously you need the social media. You need to have said on social media, I'm going to storm the Capitol tomorrow. I'm storming the Capitol now. And I stormed the Capitol yesterday. You need that. But also, they have to, it seems like you're more likely to get charged with it if how far you penetrate. You know, if you get to the Senate chamber, you'll be charged with it. If you just go in 10 minutes, come out, you probably won't. And so that part, you know, he's right. There's a lot of prosecutorial discretion. And for those that aren't comfortable with that or think that's even a due process problem, yeah, that's valid.
All right. We are going to leave it here until the Supreme Court rules. And we will, at that point, return to decide how much damage they have done and how much civil liberties they have protected. As you can all see, we have been joined by the estimable Tyler McBrien. So, Tyler, give us a sense of where you just came from.
Happily. I just came from the now infamous or long infamous 100 Center Street. We just adjourned for the day. This is day three of jury selection when where I think we're all happy to say, well, some of us at least, that there is a full jury impaneled plus one alternate, which leaves us five more alternates whom we seek. It didn't at the beginning of the day, it didn't seem like we were going to arrive at that outcome. We started the day with something of a reprimand, I would say, from the judge, because one juror, after having slept on it and speaking to friends and family, felt uncomfortable about being on the jury. So we lost one juror. We lost another juror for similar reasons, though it's not exactly clear why that juror was excused. So we started the day two jurors down. And then we kind of went into this slow pace of jury questionnaire answers. Really dipped in the middle there. I think energy was flagging, my own probably included. But then after lunch, we picked back up. We had a few challenges. Both sides exhausted their peremptory challenges. And then, much like day two, rapid fire, jurors were seated, were impaneled rather, and we ended with a full panel plus an alternate, which was, like I said, I think if you had told me that at 11 a.m., I wouldn't have believed you. But here we are. It was two steps back and many steps forward.
Yeah. So give us a sense. You wrote a dispatch that is on Lawfare yesterday. And just so that people understand the workflow here, the court is sitting Mondays and Tuesdays, takes a sort of Sabbath on Wednesday, and then we'll be sitting Thursday and Friday. And so Lawfare is going to be running very comprehensive dispatches, each of which will cover 2 days. So yesterday, which was Wednesday, and we will run those on Wednesday and Saturday. Yesterday we ran Tyler's first dispatch on the first 2 days of jury selection. So tell us about, we've now had 3 days of jury selection, and there's been, it's been kind of wild and woolly. Give us the sort of overview of what you've seen.
Sure. So yeah, just a quick word on Wednesdays. Wednesdays I've been calling mental health days, not only because it's a mental health break for myself, I would say, but also because that's the day when Justice Merchan serves in mental health court. So that's one of the reasons why we are in recess on Wednesdays. But overall, it has been really interesting. I think a few themes that have surfaced are, one, Trump's ubiquity in America, in the media, among conversations. So much so that the question of whether you've heard of Trump, whether you have an opinion on Trump, it's impossible to disqualify jurors on those questions alone, because every juror will have heard of Trump. Every juror will likely have an opinion, but that's not the question at issue. It's whether that jurors can set that aside and be fair and impartial. This came up many, many times throughout the questionnaire, but then also voir dire. Merchan, I think, gave a great example today where likability shouldn't really be a huge issue. He mentioned that he himself has presided over cases trying gang members, sex offenders, and you know, people will bring preconceived notions of those people in, but he still has sat juries for those people. I think another theme that's surfaced has been quite a lesson in I think digital permanence. Several times posts by jurors from the past, as far back as 2015, 2016, and also their spouses have come up as reasons for challenge. Justice Merchan has been a lot less sympathetic to granting challenges for cause based on a spouse's post, which I think is right. But some of these posts are quite inflammatory. There was a case today when a potential juror was brought back in for further questioning, just one-on-one with counsel. And she was essentially forced to read her own posts from the past, which you can imagine is a pretty mortifying experience for someone, especially a post from 2016 when it was such a high stress atmosphere. She was reading it, and you could see she was stopping herself. She was saying, "Oh God," you know, it was almost like she was reading the post of someone else, knowing though that it was herself. So that was another, I think, big theme. And I think, yeah, just to speak to Justice Merchan for a moment, I think he's running a very tight ship. He rules pretty quickly. He's been ruling pretty quickly on the challenges. We now have a full jury plus an alternate after 3 days, which I don't think many people predicted. So yeah, I'll leave it there if you have other specific questions.
Yeah, so let's talk about Justice Merchan's admonition to the press today, which at least some people have interpreted to be directed at Lawfare. I will address that in a moment. Let's first of all just get the facts on the table. What did he say, and what conduct by the press provoked it?
Sure. So this was his first comment, admonition, whatever you want to call it, was sparked by this one juror who was, he didn't give many details, but one juror was, I guess, worried about her identity getting out into the public. And the second juror, who we're not clear why he was excused, Merchan did say that he expressed, quote, annoyance at the idea that maybe his identity would be out there. So because of that, Merchan ruled that the answers to questions 3A and 3C, or D, I believe, would be redacted. Those questions are, what is your current employer and what is your former employer? So even if the press ends up hearing those answers, he has forbidden the press to report them. The defense rose to challenge that, saying that it was actually DA who preferred the questionnaire would be read into the record rather than a written questionnaire beforehand. But despite that, we're proceeding with the same process, save those two questions being redacted. So I think that was the explicit order, but I think also the subtext was to exercise what he called common sense when reporting on potential jurors or jurors.
And just to be clear, what gave rise to this was a set of incidents Tuesday in which a bunch of reporters from a bunch of different news organizations, including you for us, revealed in live tweets or stories, or in your case, in live tweets, in other media organizations' case in stories, and in Fox News's case, I think in a frankly quite vindictive effort to, or malicious effort to, cast aspersions at individual jurors, released information that was not protected. It was discussed in open court and did not specifically identify jurors, but could be used in combination with other information potentially to identify people. Is that fair?
Correct. I think the biggest concerns were about the specific employers, which is obviously why that question has been redacted. But there was a lot more information that most outlets did not divulge. I think there was some edge cases which some outlets did divulge. But this is because I think every journalist there was exercising their judgment in real time, rapidly, without breaking any explicit rules that were set forth by the judge.
Or implicit rules.
The
judge
exactly
decides what information is available in open court. And, you know, I say we here, not as Lawfare, but the press, are in the position in real time of kind of making decisions about what information that is presented in open court and appropriate for, according to the court, for discussion in public is nonetheless too sensitive to release. And different organizations are going to make very different judgments about that sometimes. And actually, you know, I think that's legitimate.
I'd also add one other thing is that other people are present there other than the press. So I think it's also important to point out that there are members of the public in the courtroom. Each day there have been several of Trump's aides in the courtroom, not to accuse them of doxing anyone, but just to point out that there are other people present there who are also expected to exercise judgment and restraint in divulging any public information about jurors. Also, just a point of procedure as well. The jurors are referred to always on the record by their number. So it's a letter plus a number. When the jurors are giving their answers to the questionnaire, each side gets 5 copies of the juror numbers and then 1 copy per side of their actual names, which they have to return immediately after the panel exits to the court. So each side at least has seen the names, whether or not they use them or not, I'm not clear. One point of confusion that I had was in the use of open source information. At least on Tuesday, Justice Merchan seemed very interested in how at least the defense was finding Facebook pages, Twitter pages of jurors. He seemed to ask pointedly a few times whether the defense was using their actual names, and Blanche responded, not the names, only the answers that are given plus faces to confirm, which I found confusing because I didn't think there was any prohibition on them actually using names to do research, but I'm not sure.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20. So a couple of questions before I address some of these issues. Has any juror actually been publicly identified?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't been monitoring closely social media, especially the accounts of people who might want to be doxing people. I haven't really gone looking for it, but I haven't seen any names. No. I also haven't found any names, to be honest. I haven't looked.
Right. And Justice Merchan today, but he did say kind of pointedly to the press, hey, we have an anonymous jury here, and we're doing that for a reason. And it kind of undermines that if you guys give out a whole lot of PII or personally identifying information about jurors that kind of can be used to unmask them. What was the reaction in the press, among the press corps to that?
I did hear some frustration. I think some people interpreted it as a gag order on the press, essentially, especially when access has been difficult at times. I will say that many people who work at the court have been doing an amazing job, you know, trying to organize as best they can the very large number of press who want access to this proceeding. So I don't want to fault them, but I think it was, you know, some people saw it as a First Amendment violation of sorts. It was, I think, a frustration with the inability to report things that are on the record was definitely expressed by many people in the room.
And just so we're clear, what was your reaction to all of this? Do you think that Justice Merchan, like, is the restriction that he placed on the press onerous as far as you're concerned, or reasonable? What's your take on it?
I think the prohibition now on naming employers is reasonable. I think it should have been in place in the beginning. We would have had clear guardrails. I think some of the examples he gave went a little too far. One example he gave was not naming physical descriptions or accents. So he gave the example of the Irish accent that was described of one of the jurors. Physical descriptions, I assume he wouldn't want descriptions of someone's race either. But I do think these do have journalistic value. I agree that the safety and security of the jurors should be utmost and prioritized, but I would push back on the idea that none of this is of journalistic value and important context.
Yeah, I would just want to say it's unthinkable to me that at the end of the day, the racial and ethnic and gender composition of the jury wouldn't be public. I can't think of a prominent case that has the slightest bit of political overtones, in which we don't say, you know, a jury of, you know, seven men and five women, you know, half white, half, you know, black, whatever, you know, like that is more norm than exception. And that kind of demographic information in New York is not telling anything about who the individuals are.
I would also just add one more thing. I think it's also important to remember when blame is being thrown around, why we have this anonymous jury in the first place, because of fear of you know, the defendant naming and shaming people. And I want to just also point to one more quick interaction at the very end of today, which was interesting.
The defendant's supporters.
Defendant's supporters, right, exactly. Because because Trump is under a gag order himself. But that relates to this last interaction at the end of today, in which Blanche asked the prosecution for the list of the first three witnesses, and Josh Steinglass stood up and said, that's normally a courtesy. I'm not inclined to extend that courtesy to the defendant, because he has been tweeting about truthing, what have you, about the witnesses. And then Blanche offered to Merchan, you know, what if I can promise to the court essentially that my client won't post about the witnesses on Truth Social or anywhere. And Merchan basically said, you can't promise that. There's no way that I'll believe that he can uphold his end of the bargain. And so he did not order the prosecution to give those first three witnesses.
All right. So let me address some of the criticism that we have received over the past 48 hours tell you where I stand on these questions, and I say this both in my personal capacity, how I personally feel about it, but also on behalf of Lawfare. We've had two reporters, one of whom is Tyler, the other of whom is Anna Bauer, who have been very publicly criticized for things that have appeared in their tweets, their live tweets on behalf of Lawfare. I think quite crazy idea has percolated around, particularly on Twitter, which I am not on anymore, that this is, that the judge's concerns were largely or principally or significantly about Lawfare's coverage, a proposition for which there is exactly zero evidence. So here are my thoughts on the subject, and please, to everybody, and I think some of you probably know who you are if I'm talking to you, if you're hearing this, direct your criticisms at me, not at our people in the courtroom. These are ultimately my decisions about what our policies are. So the first point is, in the first instance, it is the judge's job, not that of the press, to decide what information should and should not be public in a trial. The premise of our system is that we have public trials. The press is there on behalf of the public to make public information that the judges regard as part of the public trial, and that is the presumption. And if judges don't protect information, the press always will, and in my judgment should, presume that they should and can report what is made public in open court. In other words, in the first instance, it is not the job of the reporters in the room to self-censor a whole lot. Now, this brings me to point number two, which is that every press organization, despite what I just said, has a decision to make about when and whether it is going to withhold information that is public and that they are entitled to publish. They make different judgments about that. And some of them will err on the side of anything we're entitled to publish, we're going to publish. Some of them will make judgments that are much, much more conservative than that. Roger and I, over our careers, have spent a lot of times in courtrooms. And I can't speak for Roger, but I can speak for myself. There are things that I've seen that I would not want to report. There are things that I feel very obligated to report. these judgments are institutionally different from organization to organization, and they're personally different from reporter to reporter. When we have people in the room doing this stuff, they are working in real time when they're live tweeting. It's not like, you know, when Tyler later writes a dispatch and I edit it and we have a kind of iterative back and forth about what work is this sentence doing. When he's in there and when Anna is live tweeting on pool stuff, we're making very snap judgments about what is in category one. That is, it's public. We're allowed to produce it. We're allowed to publish it. Our job is to be the eyes and ears of the public. And what is in category two, which is the, we don't want to put anybody in danger category. We reserve the right to second guess our own judgments and remove tweets when we deem them in retrospect that we may have made the wrong call or that we may have made the right call, but people are using it in ways we don't like or anything else. We reserve the right to edit ourselves in retrospect. That's the nature of live tweeting. And on Tuesday, we did that several times with a few tweets and a few items of information. So if you look at Tyler's tweet threads, there are a few tweets that have been removed, and those are judgments that Tyler and I and other editors at Lawfare made about what was retroactive judgments about what is appropriate and not appropriate for us to be releasing in the circumstances of that day. All right, so that said, here's point number five. We actually didn't publish any single piece of information about any juror that was not also published by organizations with, you know, somewhere between one and two orders of magnitude greater penetration than we have. I don't know where this idea came from that Lawfare was where the problem was, but there literally isn't a single piece of information that we put out there that wasn't put out by, you know, the New York Times or Bloomberg or Politico or Fox News. We were not among the most aggressive by any means. And for that reason, I just want to say there is literally no piece of information that is out there today because Lawfare released it, as opposed to because some other organization that reaches 100 or 1,000 times the audience that we do released it. If you want to know where I think this idea comes from, I'm not sure about this. But I think it's that we actually organize information better than other places that cover courts. And so, you know, Tyler does these threads that are extremely well organized and you can follow them. And that this, I think he learned from watching Roger do this in the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers case. And so, you know, information on Lawfare is exceptionally useful, and we try to make it really useful. And so, you know, which is another way of saying we punch above our weight. That said, there really is no information that is out there that was, you know, has been used to harass or identify a juror that's out there principally or solely because of us. And therefore, I at least have no reason to think that Justice Merchan was talking about us this morning, despite the criticism that we've received. He was pretty clearly talking about the press as a whole. And to the extent that he was responding to any individual story, I have no indication that it was anything that Tyler did. And I will note that in contrast to the organized factual presentation that Tyler did and Anna did yesterday about jury selection, There was actually a piece by Jesse Waters on Fox News that really had a kind of detailed dossier on each juror that was really designed to, sort of impugn them. And the prosecution actually specifically mentioned Trump's, I don't know what to call, bleeding of this story in its filing this morning, or to argument that as to possible violations of the court order and the gag order. Penultimately, I want to say that consistent with my first point, which is that it is the judge's job in the first instance to decide what information is public. Justice Mershon, even as he criticized the press, he acknowledged that today, and he amended his own order regarding what material is public. And I think that's the right way to handle it. And finally, and I'll just say by this, I stand by the work of our writers, and I stand by our process. And if people don't like our work product, they have many, many, many other options in terms of coverage of this and other trials. And I invite them to avail themselves of publications that are more conducive to their sensibilities, politics, and tastes than ours. We will continue to do what we do. And I would only ask that people leave Tyler and Anna alone. And my email is benjamin.wittes@lawfaremedia.org. And if you have complaints about our coverage, please direct them to me. And please understand that our people, if you think you are complaining about our people to me, you're not, because they are working very closely with me on the judgments that we're making, about which I have no apologies to make for any. So that is my the only thing I'm going to say on this subject, frankly, and it's long and considered, but I actually feel very strongly about it. So before we go to audience questions, I want to take a quick trip to South Florida, because I know there are several of you, and by several, I mean at least three, who are desperately waiting for an update on Judge Cannon. Roger, what's going on with our favorite judge in Fort Pierce, Florida?
Very quickly, there was a hearing Friday. It involved only Nauta and De Oliveira, because of the New York trial. It was two motions for a bill of particulars and one motion by Nauta to dismiss. And I believe she's going to deny all of them. She hasn't ruled yet. That was the sense from what she was saying. I think the real question is, why did she hold the hearing? Because I don't think most judges would have found it necessary to hold a hearing on these questions. They didn't seem to me to be very hard. They didn't seem to her to be very hard. I don't think she was delaying on purpose. I think it's more, you know, this sort of this all speculative. Insecurity, sort of a desire to do A++ work, being under scrutiny. But, you know, when you have 13 motions to dismiss and you're behind and there's a huge motion to compel, it's odd. Why are you doing this? There is an interesting thing, I think an important thing. She's also hadn't decided, at least when this when we began, I haven't been checking my emails. It's the setting of something called a Section 15 notice. And it's very important to the government. And they wanted it, originally it was going to take place November 15th. It's a key moment in a CIPA case, Classified Information Procedures Act. It's when the defense gives notice of the classified documents that they say they want to present at trial. And it's important because this is sort of what CIPA is all about, is preventing gray mail, which is where the defendant says, okay, you can indict me, but if you do, I'm going to release national security secrets on my defense. And that used to be quite a deterrent, and there was no way to assess, is he bluffing and what does he mean? What's he got? What are we dealing with? And SEPA puts all of these issues out front before trial. And the beginning of that process is the defendant gives notice what he's going to use. And then, you know, that sets in motion a series of things. And the government goes back to the intelligence community and says, what do you think about these things? Is it really serious? Do these need to be secret? And then they come back to the judge and they say, okay, A, it's not admissible. And the judge gives a ruling on that. That's 6A. And then it says, okay, if something's coming in, maybe we can redact it. Maybe we can substitute. Maybe we can do this and that. And so a whole lot of things hinge on it. And so they wanted this, and originally it would be November 15th, then she put it off, and immediately they asked, well, can you reset it? She said, no, I won't reset it until after our March 1st scheduling hearing. They had the March 1st scheduling hearing. The government asked for March 17th, 18th, March 18th. And Trump asked for June 17th, 3 months later. And you can see. And so she deliberated on that for 40 days. And then April 10th, she finally made a decision. Okay, I'm going to have it May 7th. And so it looked like she split the baby. And then immediately Trump said, no, we can't do May 7th because we have the trial. And, it is true. They have a trial. Emil Bove, who's their SEPA person, is in New York too. But that was known on March 1st. They discussed it on March 1st at the hearing. And, the government's position is, you knew you had multiple cases. You chose to have two lawyers on the multiple cases. And you can't use that now to leverage for infinite delay. You had 90% of the discovery 5 months ago. You can decide this. So having made that decision on April 10th, now she's in a funny position. Is she going to reverse herself on a dime a week later after 40 days of deliberation? She'll look silly. On the other hand, if she's not, she's going to say no to Trump, which is something she doesn't like to do very often. So I'm really very interested to see what happens here.
All right. We are going to go to audience questions. Because of my little rant, we have less time than we usually do for audience questions. So I'm going to privilege those questions that are specifically about jury selection and the New York trial so that we can air the various issues that this week has risen or has presented. So Tyler, consider yourself the front line of these questions and take any of them that you want. Clarity asks, I would not trust Trump's legal team to keep my name private if I was sitting on this jury. Can they really be trusted not to spill to the other crazies? Do you have thoughts on that?
Not a lot. The sheet of paper they're given, they're not allowed to copy it, take photos of it. They have to give it right back. I think there's this sense that I get from Blanche that he knows that he's on thin ice, at least with Merchan. I don't know about other courtrooms. So I would be very surprised if he would push his luck in such a flagrant manner with Justice Merchan.
Yeah, so just a couple of things about this, which is the malicious release of a juror's name is a potentially career-ending move for a lawyer who has to practice in a court. And, there are lines that you push in the name of zealous advocacy for a client, which is itself an ethical obligation. But this isn't one of them. And I would be stunned if that were to happen. In addition, it is worth noting that some of Trump's lawyers in this case, particularly Susan Necklace, is an extremely fine and very well-respected lawyer. And so even if you're you know, skeptical of Todd Blanche, who is, by the way, a lawyer of reputation himself. He's not an Alina Haba. You know, even if you're skeptical of Todd Blanche, I will vouch for Susan Necklace. She would not do that. So I don't think the issue, honestly, is the lawyers. I think the issue is the client. And remember, the client also gets to look at that paper, as I recall. I don't know, like, I never say Trump would never do X because, you know, January 6th, like, he's done lots of everything you think he would never do, right? He has done. And so I think the issue is really not a lawyer issue. It's a client issue. Supergiant Robot asks, what is Trump's defense strategy in the New York criminal case? He only needs one naysayer among the 12 jurors. So this is a really interesting question that I don't think we fully know the answer to and won't until we start seeing the actual presentation of the case, starting with opening arguments, which are currently scheduled for Monday morning. Tyler, do you have a sense from having sat in court about what the defense strategy is likely to be?
Not a full sense, no. A few guesses. I think one aspect of their strategy is to call into question the credibility of the witnesses, namely so-called star witness Michael Cohen. This has been brought up several times in terms of, you know, the fact that he pled guilty before, that he's committed perjury, that he was publicly, it turns out, lying on behalf of the client, you know, but then switched it. That being said, the prosecution has gotten ahead of that a few times. Twice now in voir dire, Joshua Steinglass mentioned the, quote, baggage that the witnesses have and asked jurors. I think they're trying to correct for that in the jury selection process because the prosecution sees that coming, essentially. So that's definitely, I think, going to be a big aspect of the strategy. I don't know the contours of the rest of the strategy yet. It hasn't been so apparent, I would say, as of yet.
I will just add one thing to the strategy. Clearly, discrediting the prosecution witnesses, as it always is in a defense case, will be an element. But I think there's another element that we know, too, which is the so-called John Edwards defense, right? Which is, I didn't do this to falsify business records or to, you know, influence an election. I did it because I didn't want Melania to find out about it. But of course, it didn't happen, right? Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal are both lying, but I, you know, didn't want, but even if they weren't lying, I didn't want Melania to find out about it. The sort of personal, you know, just managing personal damage, I think, will be an element of the defense as well. The questioner is correct. Remember, a win for Trump here is a non-conviction. He does not need to persuade 12 New Yorkers that he's not guilty. He merely needs to persuade one member of the jury that he's not guilty. All right, so several questions about juror intimidation from the defendant. Walter asks, could the judge consider the defendant's mumblings and glaring at prospective jurors as a form of intimidation if it persists? And the estimable Richard Wattenbarger asks, what sort of court behavior count as juror intimidation? If I recall correctly, Merchan scolded Trump for mumbling something or other as counsel was interviewing the jurors. I'm curious, though, about demeanor. If, for example, Trump fixes his menacing scowl a la the Fulton County mugshot on one or more jurors, would that count? And are there other demeanor-type offenses? So, first of all, Tyler, what happened in court with respect to mumbling, intimidating mumblings, And secondly, do either of you know anything about, you know, fixing a menacing gaze? Like, what are you and aren't you allowed to do by way of glaring at jurors as a defendant?
Yes, I can speak to what has happened so far. This question is in reference to something that happened on day two, I believe. This was when a juror was brought back in for clarifying questions. So it was just one juror speaking to counsel. And Trump, apparently, though we in the press overflow room didn't see it because the video is cut, but the audio stays on when these questions happen. Apparently, Trump was, I can't remember if Merchant said uttering or muttering audibly in her direction when she was 12 feet away, I think he said. But apparently that happened, and immediately after she left the room, before anything happened, Merchant scolded, essentially, the defense for it, saying that he will absolutely not tolerate it. He's known for being very calm and collected pretty much the whole day. That was one of the times where he was much firmer and his voice got audibly louder when he gave that directive. I'll leave it to either you, Ben, or Roger about what's permitted or not in terms of glaring, but Trump has been, at times, turning his chair to face the jury box as they're answering questions. When that happens, we can actually only see him in profile because it's the camera is pointed at him, so I can't see the glare that he is giving or not giving. I imagine that's a pretty difficult thing to figure out, you know, what's a menacing glare versus just looking at someone, but maybe Roger or Ben, you know better.
Roger, do you have thoughts on this?
I don't know the case law on glaring. I think that the earlier anecdote you described about how these little things can come back to bite you, like, I mean, not so little things, but like the fact that Merchant is not going to order them to turn over the identities of the witnesses because your defendant keeps harassing witnesses. You know, I told him not to. He does. So I'm not going to give you the names. So there's little things that, you know, you can get back at somebody for, but short of, you know, holding them in contempt. But of course, yeah. So
I would say, if I were Trump, I'd say, what am I supposed to do? You get mad at me when I glare. You get mad at me when I close my eyes and call me sleeping. What am I supposed to do?
Right. You didn't sleep today.
Yeah.
No, I will just say that usually juror intimidation takes place outside the courtroom. And by the way, jury intimidation and jury tampering, as the felony is called in most jurisdictions, is something that prosecutors take extremely seriously. Such that there are very few quicker ways to get yourself in prison than to meddle with an active jury. And so I think the general rule is the judge is responsible for actions within the courtroom, and the normal remedy is contempt. And that is kind of what he was threatening when he said to Trump, you know, about the mumbling, don't even think about doing that in here. Scott asks, I love this question, is there a way jurors, employers, and other identifying information could be limited to the questionnaires or some sort of display to just counsel tables not otherwise shown to the gallery? Are the questionnaires preserved for later examination such that they could be leaked or followed up on for honesty? Note that I managed to include otherwise in my question. The answer to the question is no, and there's no way to do that. And the simple reason is that the purpose of having the jury questionnaire is not merely to flag issues that are per se disqualifying, like if you say, you know, I believe defendants are presumptively guilty until proven innocent, right? But also to flag issues that may be a matter for discussion between the parties. And so, you know, my employer is the Brookings Institution. If I show up and there's some reason to think the Brookings Institution would be biasing in some way in some criminal proceeding, counsel has to be able to ask me about that. And because those colloquies are part of the record, if the fact that you are an employee of the Brookings Institution is interesting, it's going to become public. And so there's really no way, at least not that I can think of, to keep that stuff hidden when it matters. And if it's not hidden when it matters, there's no reason to hide it when it doesn't matter. Am I missing something there, Roger?
Well, Tyler can check whether I have this right or not, but I think what Susan Necklace was saying today was that they had favored a written questionnaire, and you can have a written questionnaire, they fill it out and it's sealed. We didn't get the written questionnaires of the Proud Boys jurors, and that's the procedure that I think they wanted to use, and he didn't, and the people for some reason didn't want a written questionnaire. So that option was gone. And then there's another option, which is to go do a sidebar. But a sidebar, which is where, you know, the lawyers come to the bench, you know, that's tricky too. It's cumbersome in a small courthouse, and Trump has a right in New York to do it. And if Trump comes, then the Secret Service come, and you know, there are logistic things. So it's a weird sui generis problem as well.
Yeah, I'll just confirm that that's what I heard in court today. At least Susan Necklace said that they had favored a written questionnaire. I assume that would then also have been sealed, and that it was actually the DA that wanted the verbal answers given. And then it's correct. On Monday, Trump had said that he does want to be present at all sidebar conversations, and then the next day he waived that right. On Tuesday.
Right. My point isn't that you couldn't have a sealed questionnaire. It's that the moment that a question matters, i.e., like, is your employer potentially biasing, you're going to be asked about it. And that colloquy is not going to be sealed unless it's done as a sidebar. That colloquy is going to be done in open court. And so you could protect a lot of potential jurors, employers, but that's actually not the problem here, because the press cares about people who are actually going to sit on the jury, not people who are dismissed. And so I don't think the question is easily resolvable, except by the way Justice Merchan did it, which is to say, press, please use your discretion. And by the way, I'm ordering you don't report employers anymore. And, you know, and I think that's a perfectly sensible resolution.
I mean, I think it's a good resolution. I don't think it's an enforceable order, but I think it's something, you know, I think reporters probably want a little guidance, they'll probably follow that.
I think that's right. I think there's likely to be grumbling about it, but I can't imagine any news organization defying the order, risking contempt in order to challenge it over a day and a half of jury proceedings, when you could simply describe an oncology nurse rather than a nurse at a particular hospital, right? So we are going to leave it there, with apologies to the number of questions that we didn't get to. I usually try to leave half an hour for audience questions. Couldn't do that today between the discussion of Fisher and the discussion of the case. So a reminder, folks, we are changing format for the direction of this case. We will be moving the weekly roundup to Wednesday, the Justice Merchan's mental health Sabbath, and we will be doing daily live streams. They will be much shorter than these. They will not have audience questions. They will be roundups of the day, starting on Monday, when I believe we are still scheduled for opening arguments, and Justice Merchan has declared that court will end at 2:30. I believe that is for Passover-related reasons. Is that correct, Tyler?
That's right, yeah, for Monday and Tuesday. And then a reminder that Tuesday morning is the contempt hearing
right,
as well.
Right, so we will be doing live streams both Monday and Tuesday. And then Wednesday, we will do the weekly roundup with live streams on Thursday and Friday. All of these will be on the Lawfare podcast feed as well that evening. And by the way, if all of this sounds like a major undertaking to you, it is. And if I sound a little bit grouchy about people going after our people in the courtroom over this stuff, I am. And I'm really proud of the work that Lawfare is doing. And if you think it is important and you think you're going to benefit by it, please become a material supporter of Lawfare, which you can do at lawfaremedia.org/support. Become a regular Patreon donor and your questions can be asked, or in this case, left on the list of unasked questions with my apologies. We are going to leave it there. See you next week. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter on our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You will also be able to pose questions to our panel and become part of our conversation by joining our webinar, which is available only to our supporters. This podcast is edited by the one, the only, Jen Patya. Your audio engineer this episode was the one, the only, Anna Hickey of Lawfare. Our music is performed by the one, the only, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.